Episode 192 of Wheel Bearings brings an updated lineup as Roberto Baldwin joins Nicole Wakelin and I in place of Dan Roth, who just started his new job. We talk about the rip-snorting Dodge Durango Hellcat that just left Nicole's driveway. Robbie takes a ride in the new Lucid Air Grand Touring and contemplates moving his house with the GMC Sierra Denali HD diesel, while I ponder how the Chevy Volt might have evolved into the Toyota RAV4 Prime. In the news, Toyota launches Beyond Zero, Cadillac prices its first EV, and Stellantis kills the too expensive Giorgio platform. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. Welcome to episode 192 of Wheel Bearings. Changing it up again this week. I am Sam Abul Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin from Let's Go Boston Globe this week.
All right. Boston Globe. And who's that other guy?
Hi, I'm Roberto Baldwin, and I'm from the internet. I write for a couple different places, and I'm newly freelanced, so I just it's anarchy over here right now.
Then you have to pick one.
Should be.
Oh, I have to pick one.
You're freelance. You just rotate a different one every week. Like pick one you want to talk about. So this week you work for
Engadget.
Okay.
All right.
Tech blog extraordinaire Engadget. Ooh. which
Robbie, you are joining us as our full-time replacement for Dan Roth, who's gone on to the gray side, because he's not really in PR, so he's not on the dark side. He's on the gray side doing internal comms, employee communications at Ford. But Dan will be joining us from time to time for some special stories, like the interview he did with Peter Egan a few weeks back, and various other things that don't conflict with his job. But Robbie, tell us a little more about yourself. What's your history? What have you been doing?
Oh dear. So I am an automotive journalist. I transferred from tech to automotive full time about 5-ish years ago. It's funny because I was a car nerd far longer than, way before I was a tech nerd. I had, I was working on cars before I didn't have a computer till I was 21. But as a small child, my parents had me working on cars with them. My parents had Challengers and Javelins and whatnot. So my mom is more of a car nerd than my dad. My dad is an airplane mechanic. But we learned how to work on cars. I learned how to work on vehicles from my dad, and I learned how to drive from my mom because my dad drives very slow and sometimes in the left lane, which is it's incredibly frustrating to be in the car with him. I hope he's not listening to this.
All right. Well, we appreciate you agreeing to join Nicole and I, and we're looking forward to this. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So why don't we dive right into the garage? Nicole, had something kind of interesting this week. What were you driving?
I know. And they literally just took it away. Like you hit record, you said ready to record, and I heard it start up in the driveway and disappear. I had the Dodge Durango Hellcat this whole week, which was, I love it. I love it. Can I just say that's my whole review?
Tell us, what did you really think of it?
It's because there's this element, I feel like there's this element of crazy to kind of anything that Dodge does these days. Like, can we put a Hellcat in it? Sure. It could be a tricycle to put a Dodge, badge on the side of it and just stick a Hellcat engine in there. And it's brilliant. It makes no sense, but it's brilliant. It was, what is this, like 710 horsepower, 645 pound feet of torque. This thing moves and it sounds amazing. Like I said, I'm inside my house in the back of the house, and they just came to pick it up and I could hear it start up in my driveway. It sounds brilliant. It looks brilliant. It wakes up your neighbors, which is kind of fun. I loved it. I loved it. If I had, more than just my husband and I and my soon to go to college daughter, and I had any reason at all to buy an SUV that large that I could come up with, it would be on my list. Cause it's just such a fun, redonkulous vehicle to drive.
Robbie, have you ever driven any of the Hell, like driven the Grand Cherokee Trailhawk or the Durango Hellcat yet?
I have not driven the SUV variants of the Hellcats, and I feel like those, to me, those actually make a little bit more sense than the than the sedan, the Charger, the Challenger, etc. Because those cars are they're bricks. They're bricks that go really fast. But you're kind of like, well, maybe it'll handle well. No, not really. But if in an SUV, you know what you're getting when it comes to handling. And so you get this raw power in an SUV to go quickly for no reason other than to go quickly in a straight line. And you can throw your kids in the back, and it has all the utility of the SUV with the ridiculousness of the Hellcat.
And you know, certainly I can't argue with the whole premise that the Hellcat is absurd, you know, especially in the 2020s, you know, as, and I think, unfortunately, you know, as an enthusiast, you know, I think its days are probably numbered. You know, I don't think.
Don't, you know, say that. I'm not listening to you. La 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 la. I'm not listening.
I think the practical reality is, you know, we'll probably have Hellcat vehicles from Detroit for a few more years yet, but I think that we're, well, frankly, you know, Stellantis is running out of things to put the Hellcat in that they could reasonably put it in. You know, you've got the Ram TRX now, which I'm getting one of those in a couple of weeks, and then the Durango. And I've been fortunate enough to drive a few of these Hellcats. You know, I drove the Trackhawk a couple of years ago and had it in early February. And, you know, one of the things that that the SUVs have that the cars don't have is all wheel drive with the Hellcat engine, which means you can actually put that power down to the road. I did 0-60 runs on cold, wet pavement in an early February morning with the Trackhawk, you know, like 3.5 seconds, you know, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's kind of the brilliant thing about it. I mean, like you said, the sedans are just these bricks that you want to handle better than they do, but they're really straight line drivers, but you're not expecting to take your Durango or your Trackhawk over to a track. I mean, you'd like to, but the reality is most people won't, but it has all the fun and that sort of visceral feeling of power and the sound of it. And that just excitement of, if you know, you mash the gas getting on the highway, you're getting pressed back in your seat. And so are your kids, and they're giggling about it. You know, you get all that, but then when it snows, you're good to go. It's not suddenly like you have to say, okay, this sits in the garage because there's no way I'm taking this out on the snow. I'm not going to, you know, wrap myself around a tree. No, this is perfectly fine in the snow. In fact, we had, because, you know, New Hampshire, we had 3 inches of snow last week and the roads were a mess. No one really expected it. It was one of those like, oh, we're going to get a dusting. And suddenly we didn't get a dusting. I was out and I'm like, I'm in a 700 plus horsepower SUV that could, like, you know, race down the highway if I was so inclined. And yet I am just driving along, handling the snow, no problem. And you can't do that in very many vehicles.
Does it still have winter tires on it?
No, it did not have winter tires even. It was just, I think it's just all seasons, but they were not winters. It's weird. We get a mix of vehicles with and without winters up here. A lot of our stuff just comes up with all seasons.
So as a general SUV, setting aside the powertrain for the moment, what do you think of the Durango? How does it compare against, you know, other largish three-row utilities?
Yeah, I think, you know what? I think it's good. It's one of those, it has a very just sort of distinct character. It has a very Dodge character. Nothing is delicate or refined or pretty. It's all very sort of bold and in your face in terms of the styling inside. And it's even that with just the look of it and the comfort of it. It's big and comfy and cushy. There's nothing like, don't expect little sports seats to hold you in. Don't expect it to look all elegant. It's this sort of beefy, comfortable interior. I like the idea of having this if you have kids, because it feels like it would withstand what kids do to a car. Like, I don't want a luxury three-row SUV that I'm going to worry about my family getting into with their winter boots and their cup of milk that they spill and the mandarin oranges they spill everywhere when we go through the drive-thru at McDonald's. I want a car that I feel like is going to survive that and be like, okay, well, I got to clean this up, but it's going to be okay. It's very, it has the sense of being sturdy enough and comfortable enough and sort of like an upscale feel without being delicate. It's not a delicate car. It is a big, beefy vehicle in every way, but it has all the stuff. Like you got a million cup holders, you got rear seat infotainment. You know, it has the stuff you need to work as an SUV. So I'm a fan of the Durango, even the not Hellcat version.
So you make your kids eat their fruit before they get their fries?
They don't get, well, now they can get whatever they want because their teenagers are like, I'm getting the fries. When they were little, they would not get the fries. It was just the fruit. I was that mom. But I mean, really, seriously, it's mandarin oranges and sugar syrup. I was doing the best I could, you know?
All right. So last week you had the Highlander, this yes. week Durango. Which one, Highlander or Durango?
I like the Durango because I like the big, bold, large, in-your-face feel of the Durango. If you want something more refined, the Highlander is a great choice. It's not like one is bad and one is good. Me personally, I just like that big, bold feel of the Durango. I like the look of it on the outside. I like the feel of it on the inside. It feels tough. It feels like it can stand up to stuff. So Durango.
Does the 21 Durango have the new Uconnect 5 system in it, or is it still the older system? I can't remember if
God, now I'm drawing that. A blank because I was
because they updated the interior on the Durango this year.
Yes, it does have Uconnect 5. Sorry, I've been a bunch of FCA vehicles late, or Stellantis vehicles. I'm like, wait, what did this one have? Yeah, it does have the Uconnect 5, which if you haven't, have you had Uconnect 5 vehicles yet, Sam?
I've had it in the Pacifica, yeah.
I like Uconnect 5. I think it was a nice upgrade, but I've always been a Uconnect fan. I think it's more like one of the more intuitive, easy to use systems. Like if you're the passenger and suddenly your driver says, can you do this? You can do it without wanting to take a sledgehammer to the screen after 2 seconds. You can find exactly what you want. So I like Uconnect. And this one's just faster and a little bit more slick. So they did a nice little upgrade.
Uconnect's like the Hyundai's experience. You get in, like, oh, this is essentially like a tablet. I know how this works because I've been using a phone or a tablet for the past 10 years. They don't try to like gussy it up with, you know, some sort of insane UI system. They're like, this is what you're used to. Enjoy.
Yes. And I think that's how it should be. I mean, we all plug in our phones to, you know, have Apple CarPlay and Android Auto because we like what we know. Just let us kind of sort of have what we know. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. Give us a nice, easy tablet-like system. Everyone will be happy.
So, Robbie, have you tried the new Uconnect, the Uconnect 5, which is based on Android Automotive? Have you tried that one yet?
Let me think. When's the last? No, I haven't. I haven't tried Uconnect 5 yet.
Okay.
Uconnect 4, I was like, well, this is fine.
Yeah. And, you know, 5, the interface for 5 isn't dramatically different. You know, the big thing is instead of being built on QNX, like the previous versions were, it's on Android Automotive, but FCA Stellantis took a little bit different path from most of the other automakers that are doing it because they opted not to include the Google Automotive services. So you don't get Google Assistant, Google Maps, the Play Store. They're using Alexa, TomTom Maps. And they've got their own little marketplace that you can download apps on. So it's running Android underneath. It doesn't look like it. Mm-hmm. Other automakers are using the Google Automotive services part of it. So, how much was the Durango Hellcat?
The Hellcat, the base price on this is, are you ready? $80,995. Mine has
just your average family
sedan. Right, your average family sedan, totally in budget. Mine had some extra little bells and whistles. So mine came out at $92,360. It's a lot.
That's a lot of Dodge. You know,
but it's like it's luxury. it's luxury car territory for the person whose goal for luxury isn't I want the fanciest leather and open pore wood and carbon fiber and genuine chrome. For the person whose luxury experience is
you're trading fancy,
I want
for
that
fast,
power. I want that doing. Engine. That's what you're sort of paying for with that. Yes, trading fancy for fast. If you want fast, go with the Durango. If you want fancy, go with an Escalade.
So, you know, I mean, there are other fast SUVs out there. You know, you get the BMW X5M and X6M, the AMG, Mercedes AMG utilities. I assume you've driven most of those. You know, how, and you know, they're a similar price point in that, you know, 90 to close to 100 grand price point. Would you, if you're spending that kind of money, would you take the Durango over that, over one of those other options?
You know, me personally, I might. I mean, I like the Durango. I like, it's not about whether one of these is really better or worse than the other. They all do the same thing. They all give you powerful stuff, but there's something very like out of control, aggressive in a good way about the Durango. It's just like, rah, it's like in your face. And you don't get that. The other, you know, other vehicles you mentioned, they have power. They will move. They've got it, but they're nice about it. They're like polite about it. And they have a different interior vibe, especially Mercedes. That is like a refined, beautiful, luxurious interior, but it also feels really delicate. Again, my kids with the Mandarin oranges, I wouldn't want to pick kids in there, you know? So I think it's a little bit, it's a little bit how you're going to live. Like, not just do you want a luxury vehicle? What kind of luxury do you want? Do you want a refined luxury? Do you want a bold in your face luxury? Do you want something that's just, you know, you got older kids, you're not worried about the interior, or, you know, you are worried about the interior. So it's not, I think they're very different. I know they compete, but they're very different.
All right, Robbie, what did you drive?
So I drove one car, but I sat in another. And I think sitting in the other is probably more exciting than the vehicle I actually drove. And so I sat in the Lucid Air Grand Touring Edition this week, this past week. It is the version of the vehicle that is targeting 517 miles of range, which, when people think about electric cars, for better or worse, they're still concerned about range. Lucid is essentially just populated with former Tesla engineers. Peter, the CEO,
Rawlinson.
Peter Rawlinson, the CEO, he was sort of the head designer of the Model S. So, you know, you have this entire EV legacy that's starting this new company. And it's a very nice car. It was a release candidate, so, you know, there were panel gaps. You know, they're very upfront with me. They're like, well, it's an early release candidate, but we wanted to get you inside. The chassis, the suspension, everything's about 85% done right now. So, you know, they're still working on how it rides. But for the most part, I think what they wanted me to see was the evolution of what they've done. I've ridden in the betas, I've ridden in mules. So they want, okay, this is what we're doing, this is where we're at. And, you know, it was built at their facility in Arizona. So they're building a factory in Arizona. They're already building release candidates. They're going to be building production vehicles soon. So it was, you know, it's Lucid is one of those EV companies that I think has a very good chance of actually making it. There are a lot of EV automaker startups out there who you sort of look at what they're doing and, you know, how much money they have and how much money they hope to get. And, you know, the road to the EV is just strewn with the carcasses of EV startups. And I think Rivian has a better chance just because of their, you know, their deal with Amazon. But I think Lucid is one of those companies that's going to make it. And, you know, they're targeting German luxury vehicles. That's been the target all along. Well, not all along, but within the last few years as they're building out these vehicles. And, you know, they're trying to hit above what you can get inside of a Model S. And, you know, sitting in it, it does feel nicer than a Model S. Model S is nice. It's fast. It's everything we know about the Model S. But the interior is definitely not up to par with BMW or Mercedes. Lucid is trying to be the EV company that's on par with them.
Yeah, that's always been one of the knocks on Tesla, especially the S and the X. You know, they were priced like Mercedes and Audis and BMWs, but, you know, they didn't feel like luxury cars. And of course, you know, you were paying the premium for that electric powertrain, but, you know, for with Lucid, you know, Peter and Derek Jenkins, the chief designer, you know, they really were targeting those premium brands and wanted to get that whole premium experience. And I remember the first time I met them and got briefed by them at the LA Auto Show, I guess about 4 years ago, before they publicly showed the car. You know, they walked through and it described, you know, the idea of having a car that's got the exterior size of a Mercedes E-Class, but the interior volume of an S-Class. And I know you're pretty tall. You're several inches taller than I am. And I saw you sitting in the back seat. What'd you think of the back seat roominess of, or the front seat for that matter?
You know, they're both, you know, I'm 6'3". So sitting in the front, sitting in the back, I was comfortable in both. You know, that EV platform, you know, a lot of automakers are able to show you like, hey, look, you know, we can push the wheels out. We can, you know, we expand the wheelbase. We get you more room inside the cab. And I was comfortable in both areas. You know, the front seat was comfortable. The back seat was comfortable. You know, and that's really the luxury. What people are looking for when they're looking at an S-Class is they want to be comfortable in the front seat, but they also want to be comfortable in the back seat. You can't sort of, it's not a trade-off when it comes to a luxury sedan. You can't say, well, the front seats are great, but the back seats are really tight. That's a coupe. That's a car that's much cheaper. When you're talking about luxury sedans, you need the person in the back seat to feel just as comfortable, even more comfortable in a lot of instances than the person who's driving. And, you know, it was a comfortable experience for the most part. It, you know, you can still feel, you know, they're still working on the dampeners. They're still working on a lot of the chassis. But the seats were, it was much nicer than when I did the mileage run with them, where they just had a bench back there.
Yeah.
So, but you know, in both instances, you know, I had leg room, I had headroom. I wasn't uncomfortable at any point. I didn't feel like I was being squished. It was definitely not the economy class of flying.
One of the interesting design details in the front seat is the touchscreen for the climate controls and some of the other controls. Talk about that a little more. You know, how do you think that's going to work out?
So they have, you know, they have the traditional, they have the dash cluster, they have the infotainment screen, and then they have a screen, you know, a third screen to the left for additional auxiliary functions. But then they have this fourth screen in that retracts from the dash into the center console. So it comes down, and that's where you control your infotainment system, and you can, you know, you get access to controls for the vehicle, settings, sport mode, comfort mode, et cetera. And you tap on it and it'll retract, and you can put things underneath, you know, there's a little storage area under there, and then you tap on it again, it comes back out. I feel like that's going to be a fun gimmick initially for people. We're like, hey, look at this, it retracts. And then I can put things in here, and then I open. But I think in the long run, people might put things in there, but for the most part, they're going to have it extend out and then retract it maybe once a week to get, you know, maybe their fast pass or, you know, something that they need to keep in their car, but they don't need access to at all times. You know, it's a fun little thing. It's a bit like, you know, the Corvette where it had the secret, like little, you know, you push the button and then the infotainment disappears and you can put things in that little cubby hole that nobody knows about. I mean, it's a bit like that. That's like, oh my God, this is fun. It's great. You can put things in here, but then you realize as time goes on, you're going to put something in there and then you're going to forget about it and you're going to open it up, you know, six months later. And it's all melted. You know, maybe you stuck some lip balm, some chapstick in there. Now it's all,
it's now just a mess.
Yeah.
It's just I feel like that is one of those things that you think it's going to be really cool. You see it, you're like, that is the neatest thing. I'm going to use that all the time. And then you completely forget about it.
Yeah. People are going to shove things down there that they need every once in a while. And then they're going to, and then of course, you know, 2 weeks in, they're like, what did I do with that? What did I do with my fast track so I could get over the bridge? I need to pay my tolls. What did I do with that thing?
What do you think of the design, the exterior design of the car?
I actually quite like it. You know, you still get that sort of futurism that comes with EVs that I think more automakers are sort of kind of pulling back from recently because, you know, they want to sell more EVs to more people. You know, you can't sell an i3 to more than a couple thousand people. But I think it's always funny when I'm in a car and I'm being driven by somebody or, you know, and someone pulls up and is like, oh my God. And they're looking at it and they're taking pictures or whatever, or they're like making you roll down the window. If it's just me driving out in the real world, like with the Mach-E and people are following me and taking video and taking pictures and pulling over and talking to me while I was trying to take photos of the car, that feels organic. whenever I'm with someone, for some reason in my paranoid brain, I'm like, I wonder if this guy's a plant. This person, like, is this like one of the engineers at Lucid is pulling up next to us and be like, hey, that car is awesome. You know,
automotive PR people would never do anything like that, would they? I've never heard of such a thing.
But you know, there did see some genuine enthusiasm from either a regular human or a plant for the vehicle. I do like the design. I think it's one of the first production vehicles that have LiDAR on it, and I think they've integrated that in there really well without it, you know, the puck on top. And so it's, you know, I think it has its fans. Like the Model S has its fans when it comes to design. And we'll see. I mean, it really comes down, you know, you can make the most beautiful car in the world to automotive journalists, but that doesn't mean the public wants it. And so we'll see how that pans out for them.
Hey, Nicole, have you had a chance to check out the Air, you know, when it's made appearances at auto shows in the past?
I haven't. I really haven't gotten a good look at it. So I'm listening to all this with great curiosity. My thing always with some of the EVs that they do, and I really have to see it to see if this upholds that, but is the idea that they're so clean and EV-ish inside that they come off kind of bland? Like I sort of want an EV to still look, I want it to still look like a car. I want it to still have the stuff that a regular car has, the kind of, I don't know, the pretty leather seats and the contrast stitching and the sort of personality. I don't want it to look like a console on the bridge of the Enterprise. I don't want it to be like completely plain. I don't like it that plain. I like a little bit of stuff going on inside a car. And sometimes I feel like they're too plain. That sounds like a weird complaint, but.
No, I think that's a totally legitimate complaint, you know, and I know that, you know, when I first talked to Derek Jenkins about it, that was one of the things that he highlighted was, you know, that they wanted to make this really feel like a luxury car, you know, to have it feel the, you know, like it belongs at that price point. And I think that, you know, they've largely succeeded at that, you know, and, you know, not having that stark minimalist kind of interior that you find typically on a Tesla.
Yeah, like everyone says, my husband loves Teslas, but I get inside and I feel like
we won't hold that against him.
I know, right? But they feel like, they always feel to me like they forgot something. Like, oh, we should have done another level of stuff here. We forgot this extra trim, and it's like, no, this is how it's supposed to look. And I guess from your clean, you know, living in the future kind of thing, it works. But I still want my car to feel like a car with all the little bits and pieces that make it pretty and feel like it has personality. And I don't like them. Blech.
I want to be able to reach out.
All the Tesla people are going to kill me, but whatever.
No, I want to be able to reach out and touch something tangible. Like it has tangible buttons, you know, these rollers, which are really nice for volume controls and for climate control. I want to be able to do that without having to like turn my head, push a couple buttons, push a thing. And I'm like, okay, now I turned the volume up and I haven't been paying attention because everything's on an iPad now. Yes. I think the tangible. I want something I can hold and my muscle memory knows this is there. I can do it without, you know, taking my eyes off the road. And it gives me something that my body feels like I'm still part of an organic universe.
Yes, I agree.
Cool. All right. You want to share some thoughts on the Sierra?
It is huge. I got the it is.
You had the HD, right?
I did. I had the 2500 HD with the huge diesel engine. I think it's the 6.6 liter. Yeah, 6.6 liter V8 Duramax diesel engine. It is. I'll say again. I'm 6'3". I stood in front of it, and it came up to my your armpit area, my nipples. I don't. What's an appropriate, like, what that's a weird area to
just below your shoulders
without sounding, yeah, just below my shoulders. How's that? It's a weird area to describe without sounding weird. It's an odd, and you know, you as you know, and I'm and as a tall person, you know, I'm going to have a bit more visibility than someone who is, you know, 5'11", 5'6". So they have less visibility as they're driving this gigantic machine. You know, one of the first vehicles I ever drove was a tractor. So I always have a little soft spot in my heart for diesel engines, just because it reminds me of working on a farm. But it is, it's insanely huge. It's just so tall. You know, the inside is typical truck. You know, I don't think an American truck has been built that I feel comfortable behind the wheel. You know, even before we had extra cab and extended cabs, I always felt like the cab wasn't built for a tall person. And even as we have, you know, essentially inside of the vehicles are sedans now, even then it doesn't feel comfortable. I've never felt comfortable in an American truck in a way that I would in a vehicle, just because of the dimensions, who they're building this vehicle for. I don't know if they're not building them for tall people. They've always said, you know what? No one over 6'1" is ever going to buy this thing. Everyone else is going to buy it. Or if they're over, they don't care, because they have, how much torque does this thing have? 910.
If you ever need to move, you know, you just hook a tow strap to your house and just, you know,
just take yank it,
drag it along.
So they always say, these are just like, take your house right off the foundation. If that's something you need to do, that's the vehicle you need.
I was disappointed. I was supposed to use it to tow something, and that sort of fell through. That's why I had it. And so I didn't have anything to tow. I didn't have any tree trunks to rip out of the ground. They weren't going to let me in the Redwood Forest at any point with this thing, with the chain. it's large. It's comfortable for, you know, a truck. It has a million cubby holes. It's just cavernous on the inside, like most modern trucks. It is, you know, you could put anything you want in the back and not worry about, you know, bogging it down. I could have dragged my house off its foundation and down the street, and it would have been fine. It wouldn't have had the strain. There wouldn't have been that like few seconds of the truck.
Your house would have been a shambles, but the truck would have been totally fine.
It would have been totally fine. These vehicles, they have, you know, they have all this tech, which I wasn't, you know, able to use. I was very excited about the idea of using the trailering system that allows you to see through the trailer.
Which is
cool. You put a camera on the back of the trailer you can see what's behind you.
And it's really cool.
And it disappears like it's the Predator.
Predator. They need to somehow work that into the name. They need to change whatever it's called and call it the Predator trailer system.
It's a cloaking device for your trailer.
A Klingon? Bird of prey.
Bird of prey, yeah.
The Klingon bird of prey system. It has the fact that it has that tailgate with the step is great, because it's so damn tall. You know, that was helpful. We ended up going to Home Depot and buying mulch, which is.
Do you like the fancy schmancy, the whole 85 function tailgate thing on the Sierra? Do you like it?
I kind of like it. I kept pushing the wrong button. So there's two buttons on the tailgate, and one of them unlatches the step, and the second one opens the tailgate. And what would happen was I would try to open the tailgate, and instead I would open that. I would open the step, and I was like, oh, God, and I push the step close, and then, or I'd be trying to close the tailgate, and I accidentally hit the button for the step, and then it would open, and I was just like,
don't feel that. I remember doing the same thing. Like, someone would want to see it. Like, you know, you talk about people who want to see. I'm like, oh yeah, and so the tailgate. Oh no, wait, that's not what I wanted to show you. You do this, and then you do that, and then it opens. Yeah, I kept doing it backwards, but I figured if I had it in my own hands for more than a week, I would begin to remember how the tailgate worked.
Yeah, it's definitely like that week of learning, and then once you have it for a week, you're like, look at this, I can just walk up to
it. I'm super cool, I can open this tailgate 20 different ways.
You want to see me tap dance down the back of my truck? The hitch guidance, I pride myself as someone who's really good at backing trucks up to trailers, but I would love to have tried that, the hitch guidance system. But overall, I mean, if you need something that's going to haul a planet, maybe a moon, maybe not a planet, but you know, it's there. I still have
something like Pluto size.
Yeah, like a Pluto or one
not
of
quite
our,
a planet, but close. Yeah,
not quite, you know, not quite Mercury, something a little bit
smaller.
So like
a Death Star, you could have like a Death Star totally, size.
They could have, instead of trying to blow it up, they could just thrown some chains around it and then just towed it off. And they're like, oh. So yeah, it is for the person who needs to haul or tow anything essentially without needing to without needing a truck driver license, you could probably get this. But other than that, it's slightly ridiculous. And what was the price for it? You know, it's nearly $80,000 for this.
Wow.
Yeah, $78,000 for the one I got. It was the Nolly. I had the whole you know, four wheel drive crew cab. I could bring a whole crew with me if I was allowed to do that. Yeah. Maybe in a few months, I'll get my crew together. Dance crew or work crew.
Get one of the bands, you know.
Yeah, I'll throw one. It would be a great band. It would be overkill because I don't have. It is definitely overkill for I would think 90% of the people who are probably going to buy it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, most of the HD trucks, you know, the 2500, 3500 series trucks are the majority of them are sold to commercial customers. They're not sold to individuals. And usually, you know, it'll be like the owner of the construction company or the plumbing company or the owner of the ranch will buy themselves a Denali, you know, and buy the base level work truck versions of those HDs for all their employees, you know, to use. And then, you know, they'll buy themselves a nice luxury Denali or, you know, an F-350 Limited or Platinum, something like that, or King Ranch, you know, and drive around in those.
Everyone else gets the base F-150 and they show up. It's completely immaculate. It's completely clean. They jump out and they're like, hey, you're not supposed to be doing that. And they jump back in their truck and
exactly. All right. So I had the Toyota RAV4 Prime XSE. And as I was driving this, I was thinking about it. And, you know, back in 2010, I was actually working at GM in communications at the time for a short period. This was around the time that they were launching the original first generation Chevy Bolt. Volt. The V with a Victor. The Volt, not the Bolt. Still pissed about the ridiculous naming. Anyway,
you have to call it the Bolt EV and the Volt. You don't get confused. So you can hear the difference.
When they were launching the Volt, you know, and the way it typically works in the auto industry is that, you know, you have the product development team, you know, they'll be working on the vehicle for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. And then about 9 months or so before job one, they kind of hand off most of the responsibility to the launch team, you know, that's working with the assembly plant that's going to be building this thing. And so at the time I was there, you know, the Volt team had already handed off responsibility for the Gen 1 Volt to the launch team. They were working on getting them built. And the development team had already moved on to the next project, which was going to be something called the CrossVolt. They showed a concept of this in early 2010. It was basically a compact crossover that they showed that is built on the Bolt platform using the same powertrain and everything. And they worked on that well into 2011. And then Dan Akerson, who was then the CEO of GM, you know, after they went through their bankruptcy, decided to kill that program. And said, no, we're not going to build that because, you know, people might actually want to buy that. Instead, we need to build a Cadillac based on this platform and sell it at a price point where we can actually have a significant profit margin. And the result was the Cadillac ELR, which was that little kind of cool looking coupe, you know, that was had the plug-in hybrid powertrain from the Volt. But it was also like $77,000 and about three people bought them, I think. You know, I think over the course of three model years, they sold less than 2,000 of them.
Wow.
In total.
That's terrible.
Yeah. And the CrossVolt died. You know, it never got produced. If they had continued down that path, the kind of vehicle that would have ultimately resulted was something very much like the RAV4 Prime, which is the plug-in hybrid version of the RAV4, which is now Toyota's best-selling vehicle. They sell something like 450,000 RAV4s a year. And the last 2 years in the U.S., you know, almost a quarter of them have been the hybrids. And now they have the plug-in hybrid version, which has basically is the same thing, but with a bigger battery and more powerful electric motors. So this RAV4 Prime is the most powerful RAV4 you can get, combined total of 302 horsepower. It's got plenty of grunt. It's got an 18 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery that sits underneath the rear cargo floor and the rear seat. And it's officially rated at a 42 miles of electric driving range by in the EPA rating. And, you know, I took this thing out. I charged it up and I went for a drive. You know, I put it in EV mode and, you know, put it, you know, when you can select the mode where it forces it to stay in EV mode. And even with that, you know, you still have like about 200 horse, more than 200 horsepower between the two motors, you know, the one, the more powerful motor in the front axle, and then a 53 horsepower rear axle motor. So it's all wheel drive. And I drove 43 miles of mixed driving, you know, some highway driving, some suburban, some urban city driving. I got 43 miles before the engine finally kicked on, which is really impressive. I mean, this is a bigger, heavier vehicle than the Volt ever was. And it goes farther on a charge than that little Volt. I mean, the Volt was a nice car, but it was small. It was cramped. It was a four seater. You know, it didn't have a whole lot of space inside. You know, this is just a regular RAV4. You know, it's got plenty of room for somebody your size, Robbie, and you know, to haul the kids around. And you can use this as, you know, it would be a great, you know, family vehicle if you got, you know, just a couple of kids, if you don't need a third row. You know, it's a great, you know, basic, you know, upper compact size crossover that I think is actually also pretty cool looking. I like the current generation of the RAV4. I think it's a good looking vehicle, and you can just drive it like an EV. You know, and then, you know, when it's time to take a road trip, you know, to see your grandparents or, you know, whatever else you want to do, or drive to Disney, you just keep on driving. You know, it's like the same kind of thing I've said about the Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid, where you just, you know, drive it, you know, you do your daily driving, you know, just plug it in at night, unplug it in the morning, do all your daily driving without using any gas. And when it's time for a road trip, then you just keep on going and, you know, stop at the gas station. And, you know, it's not inexpensive. You know, the starting price of the RAV4 Prime is for the SE trim level is $38,250, and the XSE, which has some extra stuff built in, is $41,575. But because it's got that 18 kilowatt hour battery, that means it's eligible for the full $7,500 federal tax credit. So, you know, that knocks it down into the low to mid 30s. You know, depending on what options you get. The one I drove, you know, had basically all the options in it, which brought it up to just shy of 50,000 delivered. But, you know, that still gets you down to like 42. And if you live in California and you have, you know, the other incentives they have in California, you think there's a $1,500 at point of purchase rebate available from the state of California and various other ones. It's actually not a bad deal. And, you know, when you consider the fact that you're going to use way less gas, I mean, even in hybrid mode, it's still, you know, rated at 38 miles per gallon, which, you know, for a vehicle this size, you know, that's pretty impressive. You know, I think, you know, this is a great option. And the only other plug-in hybrid of this type available, well, it's actually not available yet. It hopefully will be available at some point in the near future, is the Ford Escape. Which is also rated at like 40 or 41 miles of electric range. But the Escape plug-in hybrid is not going to offer an all-wheel drive option. So if you want all-wheel drive, you're limited to just this one. And there's also going to be the Lincoln Corsair, which is based on the Escape platform, which will have a rear electric motor for all-wheel drive. So, you know, I think that, you know, this is a fantastic option for somebody that's thinking about going electric, but isn't quite ready, or, you know, maybe your lifestyle means that, you know, you're not quite ready to fully commit to a battery electric vehicle. And frankly, you know, at the moment, the options in this kind of crossover are still somewhat limited, although there's a bunch more coming. There's the VW ID4 that's you can get now, the Hyundai Ioniq 5 that's coming out in the next few months. So there's more options coming. And of course, there's the Tesla Model Y. But, you know, the advantage, you know, with the Toyota, and Toyota has been doing hybrids for more than 20 years now. They, you know, they've got this thing nailed. They know how to do these things. And, you know, Toyota's got a reputation for reliability that is well deserved, you know, and service and, you know, customer service, you know, something that, you know, going with a battery electric from Tesla, maybe a little questionable, you know, if you have any issues, you know, actually getting it fixed. You know, you go to a Toyota dealer anywhere in the country and, you know, they'll have it fixed for you, you know, usually most often the same day. You know, worst case, it might be a day or two if they have to get parts from a warehouse. But, you know, that's going to be a pretty rare occurrence with a Toyota. So have either of you had a chance to drive the RAV4 Prime?
Yeah, I did have a chance to drive it a bit back. I, like you, I was a fan. I thought it was a good choice. And, you know, it was funny. There was a point where I sort of was on the whole plug-in hybrid things. I'm like, well, either, you know, just get a regular old hybrid or go with an EV. But like I was talking about the options with the EVs, they aren't the same as what you get with vehicles that are still a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid. They still feel like cars, where EVs sometimes don't, you know, on the inside. And I really liked the RAV4. I thought the RAV4 was good. I enjoyed driving it. I thought that it did exactly what you wanted to do. You know, you want to be able to plug in and take advantage of that when you can, but you don't want to feel like, oh God, if I can't plug in my car, I'm going to be stuck in the middle of nowhere. It rides a good balance and it gets that good fuel economy. And that it doesn't, it's weird because now it doesn't matter to people as much, like right now in April of 2021, because so many people are not driving and commuting the way they were before. Like it was a much bigger deal if you've been talking early 2020, where you could take the cost of that car and very quickly do the math and say, oh, I'm going to save a ton of cash on my daily commute. Suddenly now you either don't have a daily commute, you know, it's from your bedroom to your office downstairs. And it's a little bit harder to rationalize it, but I think that the rebates help, especially if you're in California, because you get extra goodies you don't get everywhere else. But I think it's a good, like, taking the like training wheels, like you aren't really at a tricycle, like at the high, just a straight up hybrid. You're kind of like at the training wheels stage when you get a plug-in hybrid. So eventually you will take those training wheels off and you will go full EV. So it's a nice like intermediary step that gets you used to plugging in without feeling the panic of not being able to.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to do the Prime. I've driven the RAV4, the hybrid, and the regular RAV4. And I am a big fan. You know, it's Toyota quality. It's, you know, the redesign is, you know, much nicer than, you know, I really like the way it looks. You get, and it's, again, it's a Toyota. So you feel like it's bulletproof. You know, the world's going to end and the only thing left is going to be Toyotas. You know, you're just
even after your last pair of glasses is broken.
Yeah. Everything. Yeah. You can't read everything in the library anymore, but you can still drive your
Toyota.
You can drive your Highlander. You can drive your RAV4 to, I don't know, LensCrafters, I suppose. It didn't seem like that was that big of a deal for that guy. In retrospect, just go to there's gotta be some glasses other people are wearing somewhere. But yeah, so the idea of the plug-in hybrid, 42 miles. And that's insane when you think about it. You know, when a couple of years ago, you know, you got you get 80 miles on an e-Golf.
Yeah.
You know, a pure electric vehicle. And, you know, that was because of that platform. But, you know, now you can get a plug-in hybrid that takes care of everything you need to do during the day without ever dipping into the gasoline in your engine. My brother owns a Volt. Mm-hmm. And he's a big fan and he likes the idea of, you know, he tries to hyper mile it and, you know, but the RAV4, you see, that's the thing that everyone wants a crossover or a small SUV. Everyone wants to be able to drive something where they don't have that anxiety of the range anxiety. In California, I live in California, so it's like, oh, well, there's a charger there, there's a charger there, there's a charger there. The rest of the country isn't like California. And, you know, it's sometimes it's difficult to explain to people in California that the rest of the country isn't like us. We're not, you know. They don't have the charging infrastructure. And so, you know, having something that like Nicole's saying was sort of like training wheels to teach you, you know what, you don't drive more than 50 miles a day. And so maybe in a few years, you know, you keep your RAV4 Prime or whatever other plug-in hybrid you have. And your second vehicle, as you age out of that, you're like, well, maybe we can get an EV for that. So now we have this plug-in hybrid that we're barely using gas, and then we have an EV for other trips around town. And so it's Toyota's EV strategy is weird, but their hybrid strategy is on point. I mean, they are the kings of the hybrid. And I've driven the Prius Prime, I'm just not a fan of that, well, of that vehicle, yeah. But I really like, yeah.
Here you get the advantages of a Prius Prime without the weirdness.
Exactly. And the backup sound in a Prius Prime that happens in the car.
Yeah. Why are they telling me? Like, I know what gear I put. I know that I'm going reverse. I am doing the reversing. I am actively the one reversing. Why are you warning me I'm going in reverse? That drives me crazy. I had someone who didn't believe me. So I was like in my driveway and I had my daughter record. I'm like, just record so that she believes me. See, reverse, it beeps inside the car.
My friends bought one. They had one for a few years, and they read the review that I had done of that vehicle, the Prius Prime, and they were like, "You're right." I think they didn't. I don't think people believe you. It's just really loud.
We would not lie to our readers.
I had the video guy with me, where I'm like, "It doesn't make any noise outside, really." He's like, "Well, you can kind of hear like a little inside. Yeah,
but inside it's like whoop whoop whoop. You're like, I know what I'm doing.
Especially like the backup camera comes on. I'm in reverse. Yes.
I'm so glad this bothers you, Roberto, because it drove me crazy when I had it.
It's all the great technology that's in the Prius Prime and put into a vehicle that is for most people is useful, what people want. And it's powerful. You know, Car and Driver did something about how it outran the Supra in a few different tests or whatever.
And I do agree. It's that if you're going to go with hybrid technology, I feel like Toyota's got that. Like they're one you can feel really confident with that. I mean, they've just ditched their gas powertrain altogether for the Sienna. You can no longer get just a gas Sienna. There's only the hybrid Sienna. So they're like all in. They got this.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
Yep.
Yeah, I would. In fact, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a Sienna Prime launched, within the next year or so, to compete against the Pacifica hybrid, the Pacifica plug-in hybrid.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Speaking of Toyota and electrification, this week they announced, I think they announced it in conjunction with the Shanghai Auto Show, their electric plan, and they're launching a sub brand called Beyond Zero, which I'm not sure exactly what actually goes beyond zero. I mean,
isn't one beyond zero?
Well, it depends which direction you're going. I mean, it could be negative one.
I guess. Yeah.
You know, I mean, is it going to consume CO2 from the atmosphere and turn it into fuel that you can then pump back into a gas station? I don't know.
Every car has a tree planted on top of it.
And all I can think of is like the ice cream place. Do you guys have Sub-Zero ice cream near you? They like make it.
No, but I've heard of it. But
think of is Sub-Zero ice cream. I expect the car to make ice cream for me, but go ahead.
So Beyond Zero, or BZ, is going to be their, or BZ, is going to be their sub-brand for battery electric vehicles going forward. And they're planning to launch by 2025. Toyota and Lexus are going to launch 15 new battery electric vehicles. Today, they have, zero, none. There are no battery electric Toyotas that you can buy, at least in North America right now. And they're going to launch 15 across the two brands, including 7 BZ models for the Toyota brand, as part of a portfolio of 70 electrified models. So basically, they're putting hybrids into everything else and launching 7 BZ models for Toyota. And the first one that they've shown is this BZ4X.
Wait, are they really calling, is it really that how you're saying BZ4X BEV concept? BZ4X, that rolls right off the tongue. We're not missing some other pronunciation, are we?
That's what they're calling the concept.
Okay.
Hopefully they don't keep that exact nomenclature for the production models, but
because like Jeep had the 4XE, but it's actually 4xE, which kind of like, okay, 4xE, that kind of, that works. But this BZI, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So they launched this, looks like a midsize crossover, you know, maybe roughly RAV4, you know, maybe between a RAV4 and a Highlander size. I think it's probably closer to RAV4 on the outside and maybe more Highlander sized on the inside just because mm-hmm. it's electric. Not a lot of details yet. I think, you know, we'll probably see a production version of this, you know, probably in 2022. But what do you guys think of this?
You know what? I would love to see them design an EV that doesn't have that really squared off snout, like they chopped the end of it off. Like, I get that they don't need a grill there, but could you like taper that sucker down so it doesn't just look like
nothing? It's a bit, yeah. It's a bit like the Sphinx where its nose was cut off at some point.
Yes, like there was this really nicely sculpted front end and like, whoops, got a little carried away. Well, let's leave it like that.
Well, I figure it works for Tesla. Yeah, I mean, that's what Tesla did on the Model 3 and the Y.
It's just like, blop.
Yeah, but it still doesn't mean I have to like it. I still like it. Why can't we make it pretty in the front? Like, it's like, oh, now that we don't need like a fancy honeycomb grill, let's just lop that right off and do nothing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, we don't need that anymore.
Just whatever. Not just part of the design process. We forget it. We stop there.
Yeah. We got the erase tool in CAD.
Just chopped it off.
We put up there? Nothing. We don't need anything up there because we don't need anything up there. You know, it has the, you know, it mirrors the current design philosophy of Toyota with everything, with the sharp angles and the, you know, more aggressive stance. And like, of course, that weird front end that's been, it's not just lopped off. It's almost like concave.
Yeah, it comes in. Yeah.
And, you know, I sometimes question Toyota's. Toyota's, when it comes to BEVs, Toyota and Honda are both just like, we don't know. everyone else,
like,
is moving forward.
They're fuel just cells, like, you know.
Like, well, you know, we have hybrids. What do you want from us? I know, and then we have fuel cells. We're like, okay. They're sort of, you know, almost half-heartedly coming out with their BEV news and their platform. And I can sit there and question them all day, but they're, you know, they also have, again, we talked about the Prime, which is a great vehicle. It's, you know, for most people, they'll be dipping into the gas, you know, once or twice a week. I'm happy they're doing something, and I'm sure it's all for, you know, for Europe and for China in order to meet regulatory constraints in order to sell vehicles in those areas. And then we'll eventually probably maybe get something here. I'm sure they're going to keep a sharp eye on what happens with the ID4 and literally every other, you know, EV crossover that's coming out before they make a decision for the United States, because they you know, it's all about that spreadsheet for Toyota.
Yeah, well, I think they are going to, they have said they are going to launch some battery electrics in North America in the next 2 years. I would not be surprised if this is the first one that gets launched. Something like this is the first one that gets launched. What about the interior?
I was just going to say, did you check out that the interior of this, how the instrument cluster looks? What is that giant tray situation?
It's a little weird. You've got this kind of channel that goes back to a digital instrument cluster that's right at the base of the windshield. So instead of putting the cluster right behind the steering wheel, they moved it forward, which I think is actually not a bad idea. You know, again, gets it closer to where, you know, closer to like to where you'd see a heads up display.
Right. Like your line of sight is more in line with the road. You don't have to look as far away from the road. That makes sense. Yeah.
I'm not sure you need that channel on either side of it. It looks a little odd.
It looks like it's begging for someone to just throw something there, because they're like, I need to like you'd throw something up there. I don't know if it would hold something, like, but the worst spot to put stuff in your car. Like, you don't want to store stuff directly in front of your face, but doesn't it feel, can't you imagine someone like just tossing their key or tossing something up there and then
Yeah, I take my wallet out of my pocket when I drive. And what if I threw it up there the first time I accelerate, just whoop, 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 whoop into my lap onto the ground. Now I'm reaching in onto the ground. I'm not driving safely. It looks like a half pipe for some skaters.
Yeah, there you go. That's
the right. Or maybe something, some sort of snowboarding X game half pipe. It's a weird decision.
So my theory is that's going to be one of the things, because this is just a concept, because, you know, it's never going to look just like this when it comes out. Maybe that will get toned down a little bit.
I hope so. Yeah. Maybe just sort of just get rid of it and just have it. Maybe they didn't want it floating, but they have the infotainment. The infotainment,
if it was just floating, if they just got rid of those, that side, like you said, the half pipe, the channel thing, I think it would not look, I don't know. I'm looking at a picture of it on my lap, you know, my computer. Maybe in person, it makes more sense than it does looking at it on the screen, but.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, Sam. In person, it's a whole different car. It looks entirely different. It makes total sense.
Even from the side view, it's very, yeah, I feel like it's very concept-y. You can see where the steering column has this like very large like cowl that sort of moves up and down. And, you know, I feel like where it's at, you're always going to have the top of the steering wheel blocking your view of whatever, something that's happening on the,
well, when you look at that display. You're right. Cause when you look at that one picture, that's just like head on, as if you're sitting in the driver's seat, you can see the top of the steering wheel actually does cut in to whatever they're displaying. It looks like they have a fake display of like the speed. It does cut the bottom of that right off.
Yeah. It's also right. And it, you know, it cuts off, you know, some of the windshield. I don't even know is that legal? Can you cut off the
top? Is that legal? Like,
yeah. I mean, within reason.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm just gonna say that I'm a big fan of the Mach-E and the ID4 idea of just sticking the display right on the column and making it just this very nice small display with just a few things. That's all you need. I'm like, I love this display.
Just put the essential information that you need while you're driving. You know, and granted, you know, this is not a particularly large display. You know, it's I think similar in size to what you get in the ID4 and the Mach-E. It's just that it's pushed out, you know, to the base of the windshield, which is a little weird, but at least it's in front of the driver instead of being off in the middle of the dashboard, like the Prius, you know, which I've always hated. It's always driving.
No, it puts your eyes in the right spot. I get that. It sends your eyes in the right direction. It keeps them higher instead of lower, which is always a good thing to reduce the amount of time your eyes are away from the actual road. But I do like you said, I like them really simple. The instrument clusters that you can configure 852 ways, I never configure them 800 ways. I'm like, I just want to see how fast I'm going. That's really, I don't need to know everything. I don't need a news scroll at the bottom. It's like you're watching like the news and there's like a ticker tape at the bottom. You're like, guys, stop. I don't need all this information about my car right now.
Speed. Nav prompts, if I'm using nav.
Yes, and, that's fair.
You know, blind spot monitor alerts, you know, if we've got that.
I'm not a blind spot monitor alert fan because I've been told that we need a New England setting. So we cut fast. So I feel like I'm always getting an alert that I'm cutting someone off. And I'm like, he's fine. Guys, stop beeping at me. So he's totally fine.
You need a sensitivity control, I take it.
Yes, exactly.
Cadillac Lyriq. Cadillac the other day made some announcements as they move towards production on the Lyriq. When they initially announced the Lyriq last year, they said that it was going to launch in China in mid-2022 and then in the U.S. late in the year. They've actually moved that whole program up throughout the course of the pandemic. They've been working away on this thing and they pulled it ahead. It's going to start production in the first quarter of 2022 in Spring Hill, Tennessee, where the plant that was originally created to build Saturn. Now it's going to be an EV plant going forward. And it's priced starting at just $60,000. And the production version looks almost exactly the same as the show car that they showed us last summer. And the only real difference is they got rid of the exterior camera mirror stocks and replaced it with regular optical mirrors. But what do you guys think of the Lyriq?
I think it looks good. I love how the charging port looks on it. I mean, that seems like such a silly small thing, but that the way that door kind of shifts down, I think the charging port looks really cool.
Yeah, but I also think the charging port is a bit like that retractable display because it's so huge that, you know, the first time you do it, you're like, hey, look at this. But then the second time you do it, you realize that the cable's now hitting the charging port door. And then eventually now you're going to have to go to Cadillac and get your charging port door fixed because the charge cable
is going to be all scuffed up.
Pushing.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's going to have pressure on it. You just ruined the whole thing. It was so cool until you said that. And I'm like, dang it, he's 100% right. That's going to be a challenge, isn't it?
I'd be curious to see how Audi's doing because Audi has basically the same setup with their charging port door on the e-tron. Where it comes out and down like that. And I'd be curious to see if they're having any issues with those getting scuffed up. Although, granted, you know, the cables, you know, are, especially the DC fast charge cables, are pretty stiff. So once you plug it in, you know, they tend not to hang down very much. They tend to go pretty much straight out. But what about the interior of this thing? You know, you've got that 33-inch LCD display, curved LCD display across the front. And this is going to be one of their first ones with their new infotainment system that is also on Android Automotive. And but they're using the full Google suite. So you can see on one of the images there, you got the Google Assistant and Google Play Store and Google Maps and the instrument cluster. What do you think of the interior design?
I like it a lot. I mean, you still have like tangible buttons, and we can be concerned about privacy when it comes to Google, but I still use Google Maps. I still use, you know, all these systems. And the fact that now you can have Google Maps in the cluster for where I'm going, as opposed to using my smartphone. I mean, that gives Cadillac back that, you know, that control over what the person who's driving is seeing, because, well, now, you know, I plug in my phone so I can use Google Maps and I can reply to text messages with my voice. That's pretty much it. Everything else is sort of, you know, I could do that over Bluetooth for music or for Audible or whatever. And so this gives them, you know, that sort of screen real estate and that brand real estate back, instead of giving it up completely to Google or completely to Apple.
And, you know, because they have the Play Store, they haven't said exactly, you know, what apps are going to be available in there. There is the potential, I think, to download other mapping apps, you know, like TomTom or Here or Sijik just launched their own. You may be able to download different navigation apps and use those. Whether they'll display in the cluster like Google Maps does, I don't know. But you know, I think there will be alternatives to Google Maps if you don't want to use that. And it also still has support for Alexa voice services. So if you don't want to use the assistant, if you want to use Amazon, you can use that. And it also has support for CarPlay. So if you connect your phone, you can use Siri.
Yeah, I like how it looks. I actually love these really, like, these long curved LCD screens. I like not having it split up. Like, I like just having this one long space. As much as I complain about cars being too clean when they're EVs, I like that clean infotainment is one big, like, just one big screen. So what is it? 33 inches of screen is cool, but I'm not a fan of the ginormous row of, are those hard? I can't tell if they're just touch buttons or they're actual buttons that are below the screen.
They're touch buttons. They're touch sensitive. I think they do have haptic feedback, but they are touch sensitive buttons. They're capacitive.
That's a lot of buttons. That is a giant row of buttons.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the stuff like climate control, you'll be able to actually do that with voice through Google Assistant and just say, you know, I'm cold, you know, raise the temperature, things like that. So you won't even most of the time really have to touch them.
Well, then why do we have a giant row of them? Hide them, make them less giant row. I don't like the giant row. You know what else? The Corvette has that giant row of buttons too inside the Corvette that I wasn't a fan. I was like, what? Why are there 850 buttons in a straight line when you sit down in this car? What is happening? So. Yeah,
I think what that comes down to is the person who's going to buy this, which is usually a boomer at this point.
20-year-olds aren't buying this. What do you mean? This isn't like a millennial car. Shock, disbelief.
And so they still want a button, even if it's a haptic feedback, something that they can push. Because they dag nabbit. My brain nabbit. Boomers, and my brain boomers were born in the 20s. Dag nabbit. It's so, you know, you get that. I like the idea of the Play Store integration, because one of the biggest issues, especially when you have an EV, is that you need directions to a charging station. And the fact that now you can get, you know, EV apps now work in CarPlay. And if you can get like Electrify America, which for some reason still doesn't work in CarPlay. But if you can get something like that and you can use that on your display as opposed to looking down at your phone every, you know, couple minutes to figure out like, where am I going to pick up this to get my car charged, which is a huge deal for, you know, any EV, at least for the next, you know, 5-10 years until we actually have infrastructure that's built out to where you're not like, you know, sort of freaking out when you're driving on a long trip and you realize, oh God, I have to charge. I got to go find the community college.
Yeah. Well, actually that's where the charge point stations nearby me here are, is at the Wet Washtenaw Community College in the parking garage there. And that's when I had the RAV4, that's where I went to plug it in because I was trying out charge points app, which now has Android, or at least there's a beta version that supports Android Auto. And so I was using that through Android Auto and found a couple of bugs with it that I reported back to ChargePoint, but that's getting there, you know. So you'll actually be able to, you know, if you've got the ChargePoint app on your phone, you set up your account on there, it'll you can hit that app. It can show you locations of where chargers are nearby. And when you go and plug in, you can activate the charging directly from the screen. You don't have to tap your phone on or anything, just plug in and hit, you know, start charging. So that, and they have that for iOS already, so you can use that in CarPlay, and the Android version will, the Android Auto version will be coming out sometime soon. I'm curious what you guys think of the lighting on this thing, both the C pillar as well as the front lighting, you know, because the front in particular, you've got that. You know, as you walk up to it, you know, it does this little dance of all these LEDs, you know, and kind of smiles at you as, you know, to say hello as you're walking up.
I'm kind of okay with the light. I mean, I don't love it, but I like when cars have like puddle lights. I know that's the silliest little thing. Like when the puddle light in a Mustang looks like a Mustang, I'm like, hee, cute. Like I like the little lights and stuff. I'm all about these little light accents to make my life happy. So I think it was kind of fun.
You think everyone at Audi's like, oh, really? Now you guys want to do this?
All right.
I like the lights. It does remind me of that one whale that has that sort of grill across its mouth.
Oh, like a blue whale.
Yeah. And it swims and it uses it to filter out all the plankton. So yeah. it gets food that way.
What you guys aren't seeing is Roberto trying to mimic with his hands what a whale looks like.
Oh, sorry. I talk with my hands
a
lot.
It was awesome. Like I get what he's trying to say now.
The Patreon will now just have me making hand gestures. This is how a whale looks, everyone. Yeah. And he's got his thing. I'll do little drawings of the whale and it'll look really bad. And it'd be the worst version of Pictionary ever. But I, you know, if you have, I think differentiation from everything else that's on the road is sorely lacking in ICE vehicles. Everything sort of looks like everything else from more than 50 feet away to the average person. So I think this is going to be like, oh, look at this. I think that's why the Mach-E, when I had it, like got so much attention because it sort of does look a little bit different from everything else, more so than, you know, your average ICE vehicle. So I think doing this will help Cadillac at least like put a stake in the ground. And when you see it, you know, that's a Cadillac.
Yeah. And, you know, like we talked about earlier with the Toyota, you know, when you don't have the need for, you know, a traditional grill for cooling, you know, you just need a, you know, small opening to cool the battery, you want something up there. I mean, because otherwise you're just going to have this expanse of blank bodywork like you have on a Tesla. And, you know, how do you distinguish different brands? You know, I think this is an interesting way to set Cadillac apart, you know, give it a different look, you know, to move it beyond what current Cadillac faces look like and give it something that's different.
Well, and you know, when you're talking about the boomers wanting their buttons to push. Also, if you're a boomer buying a Cadillac, you kind of want everyone to know that you got yourself a Cadillac, like fancy car. And it adds another element of like, I just didn't get a Cadillac. I got a really cool Cadillac. Look at my Lyric. It's the fanciest. So it kind of falls in line with that idea of who would be buying this one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And during the briefing they did the other day, Rory Harvey, who's the head of Global Cadillac now, one of the things he mentioned during this event was going forward, Cadillac will not be introducing any more new internal combustion vehicles. So they're going to do updates on the ones they have. So, you know, the Escalade is going to get some updates, XT4, XT5, XT6. But going forward, every new Cadillac that's launched is going to be electric. And their goal is by 2030, they'd like to be selling nothing but EVs. This is the first. And then the next one in the lineup is going to be the Celestiq, which is going to be their big flagship sedan, which is kind of interesting looking. They haven't shown it. They're going to show it publicly, I think, sometime this summer. That's going to be a competitor for, I think, or maybe even above something like the Lucid Air Grand Touring. It's going to be hand built in Detroit, very low volumes, and they've talked about a very high price point. The Lyriq is going to start at 60 grand, and at 60 grand price point, you get 100 kilowatt hour battery pack, over 300 miles of range, Super Cruise are all standard for that 60 grand. We don't know, I'm guessing that there will be plenty of options that take it up closer to 100, but that's actually a surprisingly reasonable price. It's less than what I was expecting for this car.
Mm. Yeah. The price points, it's, especially when you get the federal and state tax credits, this is going to do well in LA, especially, as you get.
Well, for now, at least GM doesn't have any federal tax credits available. They sold their 200,000. Yeah. But depending on what gets passed by Congress from this infrastructure bill, they might have some new incentives, federal incentives available. But
GM and Tesla, they're just like, oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure GM has lobbyists and Tesla has Elon texting people.
All right. So
Tesla has Elon. Okay. They don't need lobbyists.
Cadillac Lyriq, BMW iX. Which one would you choose?
I don't know.
I like the way the Lyriq looks compared to the iX. I know that's a weird thing to say.
I don't think that's weird. the iX is not that attractive.
Yeah,
especially the front end.
The front end is so. I don't know, and it's all sharp and stabby. It's like a papercraft. It's a papercraft.
Pedestrian
car.
Friendly.
Yes. Yeah.
I feel like the iX doesn't have the personality. There's more personality going on in the Lyriq.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm going to have to go. That's a toughie.
It's not a toughie. I really don't like BMW's wheels right now. Lyriq. Oh my God. I can't. The two giant. I don't like. I'm going to go Lyriq. The beaver teeth in the front. I can't. I don't know what's happened
here.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to say Lyriq. You're right. I'm gonna have to say Lyriq. I sort of like the sort of almost deconstructed interior of the iX, but at the same time, I still have to drive it around, and people have to look at me, and they were going to judge me. So Lyriq.
It's like being a green bubble on Apple Messages. Yeah. Last item, Stellantis, formerly known as FCA, Fiat Chrysler and PSA, has decided to kill the Giorgio platform. So this is the platform architecture that they developed for the Alfa Romeo Stelvio and Giulia. And back in 2014, when they first announced it, Sergio Marchionne talked about this being the basis for at least 8 new models across Fiat Chrysler and, hundreds of thousands of units a year. And this was going to be their premium rear wheel drive, all wheel drive platform. And, it was supposed to be the basis for a new version of the Challenger, or replacement for the Challenger and the Charger and the Chrysler 300. And it's dead now. they're not going to do anything with it going forward, except there's going to be one more Maserati midsize crossover that's basically a derivative of the Stelvio, and that's it. nothing else because it's just too expensive. It's good, but it's expensive.
Yeah. At least we got the Giulia and the Stelvio out of it. Yeah. I mean, those are two wonderful cars that I would never buy. I would maybe lease for 6 months, but you know,
why the would Giulia's, you not buy is, it? Why, because you've worried that it would last beyond 6 months.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it would last at least 8 months.
Well, if you got at least a 3-year warranty, you know?
Yeah. If you got the 3-year warranty, okay. If you get a 3-year loan or the 3-year lease with the 3-year warranty, you know, if and all the phone calls you get, you just say yes to every phone call about your car warranty. you're golden. I love the Giulia. I don't care what variation. I don't care if it's a low end. I don't care. Everything about the Giulia is just a wonderful car. I really like the Stelvio. But yeah, it's expensive, like you said. And at some point, you have to look at the future and be like, well, we need to consolidate.
I love the Giulia. I'm with you. I love the Giulia. It's like my favorite car. I don't care how reliable it is. I love that thing. And people can mock me all. If I could buy one, I'd be like, sure. I don't care if it spends half its life in the garage. The other half of its life, it's going to make me so happy. I would still buy it. So,
yeah. I when I lived in San Francisco, you get a lot of cars, BMWs, you know, i8s, whatever. I had the Giulia. And one of my neighbors who would walk, he would walk his dog every night, and he'd come, you know, I'd be outside or what, and he would talk to me about the cars. And I had the Giulia parked on the street, and he's like, "That doesn't seem like the kind of car you should have parked on the street. You should put that in your garage."
Really?
The Giulia, above everything else that I had had, that was the car that he was.
It's because it looks so different because you never see them. So when you do see one, you look at it and you think, whatever that is has to be special and should be taken care of, you know?
Yeah.
And Nicole, you just spent a better part of a week in a Stelvio driving cross country with Rebecca.
I did. And yeah, that's, I mean, I'd never spent more than, I don't even think I've had one for a press loan for a week. So I've only ever spent 8 hours at a time in any of them, I think, you know, for like on a drive. But the Stelvio was fantastic. I really had no complaints about it. It was comfortable. It did it. Everyone was sassing us the whole way. One person gave me you're driving cross country. He just put up the roadside assistance number for Alfa Romeo as a comment. And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, fine. Do that, whatever. But we didn't have any issues. It handled beautifully. And we didn't have any snowy weather, but we had some crummy, it was just mucky weather. Apparently when they sand the roads in Denver, they use a pound of sand for every square inch of roadway. So sand everywhere, and so it's so it was kind of pain in the neck to driving. So even the nice driving and the not nice driving weather-wise, it's a great vehicle. I loved it. It was comfortable. I mean, we drove across the entire United States in that thing, and I never felt like, get me out of this. It's loud. I need a break. It's uncomfortable. I need a break. It was comfortable right up until the time that we got to the hotel each night. So I loved it. I'm a fan.
And, you know, I've driven both the 2-liter versions of both, you know, the Giulia and the Stelvio, as well as the Quadrifoglios. And I am a huge fan of the Quadrifoglio. That twin turbo 2.9 liter V6 is just, it just sounds so incredible. You know, you stand on it. The one issue with those though, is if you're driving into central Ohio, the turbo, they recommend, or, you know, actually I think it might even say requires, premium gas. And I took the Stelvio Quadrifoglio to drive to Columbus for a Honda event from my home near Ann Arbor. And once I got off of I-75 and, you know, turned in towards central Ohio, it's like none of the gas stations in the small towns had anything but regular gas. And I suspect that they were probably not more than 82 octane. You know, so I needed gas because it's not the most fuel efficient car in the world. So
and how did that work out?
I put in just enough gas to make sure I could get to Columbus, and then filled it up with premium when I got there, and, you know, made sure not to get too hard on the accelerator while I was driving, which actually, when you're driving in central Ohio, is a wise thing to do anyway. You don't want to drive too quickly there because every little town's got a sheriff's deputy waiting behind every tree, ready to write you a ticket for going half a mile an hour over the posted speed limit. So, it worked out okay. Yeah, I got back safe and the car wasn't making any weird noises when I got back. So I think it was all right. It survived.
That's good.
Did you whisper, "I'm sorry," to the car as you were putting the 82 octane?
I did. Yeah, I'm so sorry, baby.
Petting the fender, trying to keep it calm. You know.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm feeding you McDonald's instead of.
It'll be okay. Don't worry.
There's a filet the next state over. I promise. Yeah,
I'll get you the good stuff as soon as we get to a decent town. Yeah. let's hit a couple of listener emails before we wrap it up for today. First up, Ken Brank, and this is actually kind of related to something you were talking about earlier with the Sierra, Robbie. In episode 188, you were discussing commercial driver's licenses in conjunction with the F-350, which Dan had been driving. With these trucks, it's more likely that the requirements kick in based on what you're towing. In California, for instance, a travel trailer over 10,000 pounds GVW or a fifth wheel over 15,000 pounds require a non-commercial Class A license. Most states base the requirements on the towed trailer. Some combine the weights. A common misconception is that folks think it's the actual weight that establishes the requirement. California, at least, it's the weight rating that sets the requirement. So, Robbie, you don't have a commercial driver's license, do you?
I don't. I thought about getting one, and then someone pointed out that if you have a commercial driver's license and you get pulled over with your regular driver's license, you get really hosed because you have this commercial driver's license. Like you're held to a higher expectation. So I was like, yeah, I don't want to be held to that. I haven't been pulled over in, oh my God, like 8 years, which is considering what I do. I'm like, wow,
yeah, that's pretty good.
But I don't want it when I do get pulled over for driving too quickly. I don't want to be extra zapped because I got the commercial driver's license.
Extra zapped. That's an official term. I was extra zapped.
Extra zapped. Extra zapped in the bank account area.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I think the heaviest trailer I've ever towed was, I want to say like 12,000 pounds, you know, a conventional trailer, a 12,000 pound trailer on a GM heavy duty pickup drive about 10 years ago. And, you know, that was driving this 3-ton truck pulling a 6-ton trailer behind it through the mountains of West Virginia, you know, and I had like 5 minutes of coaching from a GM engineer before we started. I towed small trailers before that, but never anything that big. And he said, yeah, it's no problem. Yeah. Just, you know, we've got the trailer brake control. It uses the variable nozzle turbo for engine braking when you're going downhill. You know, when you turn on the trailer brake control, it'll crank the vanes in the turbo back to give you more back pressure and slow you down without actually hitting the brakes or downshifting. So it was, and said, just rely on that. You'll be fine. And I said, okay, fine. No problem. And it worked out okay. I'm still here.
I think the same thing I've done. I did, only time I've done any kind of heavy duty towing was on a Ram program. Again, never just on my own. It was on a program. And it was the first time I'd towed anything significant. And I actually was, my drive partner was a guy who does towing stuff all the time. Tim Estradale does pickup truck mm-hmm. talk yeah. plus SUV. I think I got it right. I may have mangled that name a little bit, but I was like, Tim, I don't know what I'm doing. He's like, you got this. And it was great to have someone sitting in the passenger seat to kind of like, this is how this works. You're fine. I'm like, oh, okay. Now that I have someone coach me through this, this is not so hard. But when you look at that, they're like, get in there and tow that. You're like, what? You know?
Yeah. Just someone saying, you know what? You got this. You're like, okay.
Yeah, you're like, sure. All
right. As opposed to
wrong.
He doesn't seem to be jumping out of the truck in a panic. So I feel like I do have it.
You don't see him texting 911 and then hold his finger over the go
just,
button.
Just in like, case.
Yeah. He seemed pretty relaxed. So I thought, okay, if he's not panicking, I'm doing okay. Yeah.
All right. Last one from Adam Jakowenko. Adam says, a Patreon supporter is kind of like a boss, right? Regardless, I hereby forbid Sam from leaving the show. That is all. Adam, don't worry. I'm not going anywhere. I'm sticking with this till the bitter end, till the last person has stopped listening and downloading. I'll be here. He says, I'm confident the show will be as entertaining, still be as entertaining and informative as ever. And if you ever have listeners on the show again, I'm game. Well, I would say that based on this first outing with you, Robbie, that it has, I personally think it has lived up to expectations, which, you know, it's a low bar for us, but you know,
I'm quite pleased.
Yeah,
this has been fun.
I think this is going to work out just fine, and we will definitely have more live Zoom shows with listeners again in the future. As I said, you know, Dan will be back from time to time with some special stories. But I'm so glad you agreed to join us, Robbie. This has been fun, and Nicole, as always, great to have you here.
Yeah, this is working out. Hey, yeah. Do we have time to do one more question? I have a question someone asked us on. It's on Twitter, so it's not in our show notes. So, okay. I'm going to have to read it from my phone. It's from Adam J. And he said, can you tell us, number one, the cars you all currently own and drive? And number two, your favorite car you've driven in the last year? Sam, you go first.
Okay. So in the garage, we have a 2017 Honda Civic hatchback, which is my wife's primary vehicle that she drives, but I occasionally drive it as well. And it's bright red, race red, I think is the official color name. Sitting next to that is my 1990 Mazda Miata, which, you know, I've talked about once or twice in the past. And that's my toy. And then I would say my favorite car that I've driven in the last year, it's a tough choice. I think just as a pure favorite, I'd probably have to give it to the Corvette, the C8 Corvette, which I think is just such a fantastic car in so many ways. And especially when you consider the price point, you know, what it does for that price point is just remarkable. But I also really, really enjoyed the Mustang Mach-E. You know, it has, for the time being, at least, it is my favorite EV. What about you, Robbie?
So we have two vehicles. The one we purchased, which is a 2014 BRZ manual transmission, rear-wheel drive. It's the tall man's Miata, is what it is. I don't fit in a Miata. I wish I did, but I don't. My head always hits the roof or the cover or whatever.
There's an easy fix for that. You just never put the top up, which is what I do.
Yeah, you know, it's raining. It's
whatever.
Or I rip the seat out and I bolt in a new seat, which I did with my. My Roadster when I was a kid, is we just ripped the seat out, put new holes in and pulled it back, and then you can never move the seat. And then we also have a, this was a gift, a 2004 Jaguar X-Type.
Ooh.
The Ford Mondeo.
The fancy Mondeo. So the fancy Contour.
We had the Mondeo Sport Elite is what I like to call it. It was a gift from my father-in-law because it turned out the resale price on that thing is almost zero. they were trying to sell it. They were trying to trade it in. They were only gonna get $1,000, $500 for it. So they gave it to us. It's a 3-liter. It's the all-wheel drive. We use it mostly for the dog. We take the dog to the dog park. We use it to run errands around town. Every check engine light imaginable comes on all the time, but for the, you know, it works. It does what it's supposed to. It gets us around town. It's a weird little car. I wish he had purchased the wagon.
Yeah,
of that
would have been better for the dog.
It would.
Oh yeah, and it would be a wagon. Yeah. I would have been very excited about that. But you know, it's
so you are a proper automotive journalist. You do prefer station wagons.
My friend.
Is it brown? It has to be brown and have a manual transmission to complete the, you know.
It has to have a manual transmission. Yeah. If he had gotten the wagon with the manual transmission, I would have been like, here you go. I'd have been like, oh, I've been very excited, even with all the sort of Ford Jaguar issues that arise. My favorite car that I've driven this year, and this really brings me back to my old WRX that I used to have that the engine blew about 8 years ago, was the STI Series White, and I'll explain why. First, if you own a WRX or an STI, you learn how to drive it. You can't just get behind the wheel and drive that car. Like the second gear is super short. It's built for flying up hills and jumping over. I don't know.
It's a rally
hills.
Car.
Rally, it's a rally car. So it's got a very weird, you know, the gearing's very weird. Everything about it is sort of odd and you have to get used to it. But if you have that ingrained in your DNA from driving one for a while, whenever you get into even a new one, you're like, oh yeah, this is it. And I really love it because I live in the East Bay of the Bay Area. And while we have, nice twisty roads over here near my house, they're also pitted and they're full of holes. And, you know, I've had two Vantages and both of them, it's just like, it's teeth jarring. Everything else, you can't shoot video over here because the roads are too, tough. I usually will typically go over to Marin where the roads are much nicer and you can get some nice hairpins. And but that STI, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter with an STI.
It's designed to run through forests.
Right.
Yeah, it's designed to run through forests. And so it's fine. And so that, yeah, I think it's part nostalgia as a former WRX owner. And it's part the idea that I could just go just all out in this vehicle. And it doesn't matter how, you know, bad the road is, it'll take it and it just wants, you know, if you know how to drive it, it's ready to go and it wants to give you more.
Cool.
So. Okay, I guess that leaves me. So we have two cars, one's hubby's, one's mine. So my husband's normally driving. He has a 15 Cherokee Trailhawk because, you know, red tow hooks and skid plates are cool. So he loves it. He loves that. He loves those. And I like it too. I like Jeeps. And I have a 2010 Charger, but it's like your base, most boringest, you know, rental special Charger that I bought at the time, because remember those kids with the sticky hands and the mandarin oranges, that's the age they were at when I bought it. But it's still like, it's fun to drive a Charger. I like having it. So I like big, great big cars. Now, you know why I like the Durango as an SUV so much. So those are the two cars that we have. Favorite car is like a hard one, because I feel like I'm like listening to you guys. I'm like, oh yeah, the Mach-E. Oh yeah, that. There's a lot of good cars that I've driven. So I'm just going to pick something that you guys didn't say. So I'm going to go with what I just had a few weeks ago, which was the NSX. Because
excellent choice.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because it's expensive. Most people are never going to sit in it. But the thing was, I still feel it was the most livable supercar I've ever driven. Like you can drive it every day and you don't feel the harshness. If you want to, you know, track it, go for it. But if you just want to use that car to get groceries and your grocery list is short, yeah, you can do it. It's a very livable car and just, oh my God, is it pretty and fun to drive. So that would be my favorite car that I've had in the last year.
It's so wonderful. When I got the review unit that I drove year, I don't know, it was over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It had 6,000 miles on it already. And if it was a Ferrari or a Lamborghini,
it'd be ready for an engine anything, rebuild.
Right, it'd be ready for it. Yeah. But it's an NSX. I can take this to the Honda dealer. It was just so wonderful to drive. I drove it to Santa Cruz. I drove it around the Bay Area and I absolutely loved it. And when we were shooting video, a guy was riding his bike and he was talking to us about it. And I was like, yeah, it's, you know, it's, you get the supercar feel and look, but you also get that Honda Acura,
yes,
you know, that reliability. And he's like, yeah, I have a Ferrari and my friend has a Ferrari. And I'm like, okay. and he was like, yeah, my friend's Ferrari has to be sent back to Italy. He won't have it for 18 months.
Oh my gosh.
And for mine, when I have to schedule an oil change and that's going to take 4 months.
Wow.
I'm like, yeah, if you had this. And so he was very interested in the NSX because he had spent all this money on the Ferrari. And then he's like, well, should I drive it? I have to get an oil. I mean, you should be fine. But the idea that, you know, you have to send your car away, his friend has to send his car away to get fixed. And the idea that just to get an oil change requires a very special appointment.
See, and I know, I guess if you're spending the kind of money that those cars cost, maybe you've got, you know, four other cars in the garage. But still, if I'm going to buy a car that's that much, I want to be able to drive it. I don't want to have to think like, oh, well, I'm going to have to shuffle this thing off, like you're saying, for the next 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, whatever, to have maintenance done. And I just want to go down to the Honda dealership and have things taken care of, you know? So I like that. It was, like I said, it's the most livable supercar I've ever driven. I loved it. It was beautiful. It was fun. So that's my number one car over the last year.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's another show wrapped up. Thank you very much, both of you. Anything that you're doing this week that you want to mention to, you know, or anything that people should be on the lookout for?
I guess my next week's topic is going to be something I can't talk about yet. Well, I drove it, but I can't give you drive impressions or I'd have to kill you because it's all embargoed. So
posted pictures of it on Instagram.
So you can at least tell us what it is. I drove the Wrangler 4xE, their plug-in hybrid in Texas. I just got back the day before yesterday. So, so I'll be able to talk about it and what that was like. I think the embargo lifts on the 26th. So yeah, I can't tell you yet, but I will be able to tell you in about a week.
All right. Robbie?
I'm actually going on vacation, which means I have to rent a car, which right now is actually very difficult. All the rental services sold off a bunch of their inventory in order to stay afloat. And now as everyone's getting vaccinated, people are going on vacation. And now the supply and demand issue is become quite an yeah. So either I'll tell you how it was easy and it wasn't a big deal at all, or I'll tell you about the horror of not having a car while stuck on an island in the middle of the Pacific.
Excellent. At least you'll be stuck in an island, so you know.
I know. I'm just like I'm trying.
I don't know
I'm
how bad I can feel for you. Oh, I couldn't rent a car while I was on my vacation in an island. I don't know that I can feel sad for you, Roberto.
And I'll be meeting up with the team from Yandex, the Russian search engine company, to learn about their little rover delivery bots, autonomous delivery bots that are running around downtown Ann Arbor now.
Ooh, cool. Exciting! Yeah.
All right, thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.